Many would-be mass shooters have been stopped. Many of those shootings have been prevented. And the phenomenon of these mass killings is widely misunderstood. Those are a couple of the conclusions of a fascinating new book about this uniquely American problem. So what does the media get wrong when covering mass shootings? What can we learn from the experts who are creating behavioral profiles and trying to stop the next shooting spree? Those are a couple of the questions for this week's Reliable Podcast. Let's cue the music. I'm Brian Stelter, and this weekly podcast is our chance to go more in-depth, talking with media leaders and newsmakers about the story behind the story. And this week, my guest is Mark Fullman. He's the national affairs editor for Mother Jones, a longtime journalist who has been interested for a long while in this topic, mass shootings in America, the impact of gun violence on American society. He is out with a brand new book this week titled Trigger Points, and the subtitle says it all. It's Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. He has a lot to say about the media's coverage of these tragedies, myths that have lingered in some cases for decades, and what we all need to know about the gun violence epidemic. So let's get right to him. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Congratulations on book launch week. My impression, tell me if I'm wrong, is that this is a decade in the making, because back in 2012, you created an open source database of mass shootings in America.
Yeah, that's right. I've been looking into this problem for a long time now. And unfortunately, there's been a lot to dig into over the years. And I started learning about the focus of the book, Behavioral Threat Assessment, about 8+ years ago, and began down this road to understand better how we could try to stop these from happening.
And when you started that database, what was the scope of the problem then? And what's the scope of the problem now?
Well, it turned out that was, so in 2012 was roughly around the time that this problem was escalating. That was a particularly horrible year. If you recall, 2012 was, that July was the massacre in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. There were several more that fall. And then December that year was the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown. So in beginning to study the occurrence of these events and what was behind them, that was, of course, a key question. Are these starting to happen more frequently? And the answer to that hinges on the criteria, how you define a mass shooting. And there's been some considerable debate about that in the ensuing years. But by my more conservative approach with the database that we built at Mother Jones, the problem has definitively escalated, that the frequency of these kinds of particular kinds of attacks have gone up threefold in the past decade.
And as you said, there are other criteria, other methods. One group that's gotten a lot of attention in recent years is the Gun Violence Archive. I always notice CNN now referencing that group's data. Is that a kind of a competitor to your database?
I wouldn't call it a competitor. I've actually written some pieces about the question of how we define mass shootings. The Gun Violence Archive takes a much broader approach to defining the problem. And it really, what it comes down to is an arbitrary decision about the number of victims involved. Our database looked at cases where four or more victims were killed in mass shootings. And that was based on some criteria that was sort of loosely defined previously by criminologists and at the FBI. Through some research they had. The Gun Violence Archive has a much broader way of looking at it, which is to say they'll include any shooting in the country, no matter what the circumstance, with four or more victims injured or killed. So it's an order of magnitude much larger data set. It's different in terms of the focus. And I think it's very valuable and important work, but it's not the same thing.
Right. They define a mass shooting as any situation where four or more are injured, not including the assailant. Is that right? So that's injured versus killed. Why do you decide to focus on the ones that are mass killings? Because really, it's actually two different language. It's two different phrases, right? Mass shootings versus mass killings.
As I was thinking about it, the criteria that I was using was really about trying to focus on understanding better these events that we regard as completely incomprehensible, right? What we call senseless tragedies that we can't understand. You know, what possesses a person to go into a movie theater and shoot dozens of people? What is that all about? It's different than, you know, a more sort of conventional crime, an armed robbery that turns into a shooting or bar fight, gang beef type of thing, like what appears to have just happened in Sacramento over the weekend. So it was really narrowing the lens to trying to understand these seemingly incomprehensible, indiscriminate mm-hmm. attacks. Yeah. And let me add one other thing too, Brian, that the, you know, we see the headlines based on the gun violence archive, many, many more cases. And I think there's a certain quality to that that is unhelpful. And I've written about this in the past, that when you see a headline that says there've been, you know, 572 mass shootings this year, I think the public doesn't really know how to process that. When we hear the term mass shooting, historically, we think about Columbine, Sandy Hook, Aurora movie theater, Parkland, but there aren't 572 of those a year. So what to do with a headline like that? And I think that's part of the problem we have with people beginning to tune out this issue. They're different problems, but they're equally important problems, I think, but they're different.
Definitely multiple problems. Yeah. Well, this is why I started with some of the terms, defining our terms and where does the data come from? Because I've noticed a change in recent years in the way that mass shootings are referenced in much of the media, including CNN. And it's partly because of the gun violence archive. You'll hear, you know, there were four mass shootings over the weekend. You'll say, oh, there were. And then there are episodes like Sacramento, as you just mentioned. This happened last weekend, 6 dead, 12 wounded. And I felt like, Mark, I felt like I was part of the problem because I didn't cover it. I didn't mention it on my Sunday show or include it in my media newsletter. And I'm thinking, does the bar keep getting higher for media figures when they are assessing what's newsworthy when it comes to gun violence in America? Is that something that you explored in your book?
Yeah, to a degree. I agree with you. I think it's tough. In that we have these over and over again, and there are questions about how we frame them and how we discuss them. And there has been some positive development with the way that media covers the issue of mass shootings. And I know this is something you've thought about over the years and have talked about on your shows with, you know, the way that we do or don't give attention to the perpetrators of these attacks. Right. There are quite a lot of them where there's evidence that the offenders want media attention. And so that's changed media behavior in some ways that I think are positive developments. But the question of becoming inured to these events or knowing how much emphasis to give them is a tough one because they continue to happen over and over. And honestly, that's partly what led me into this book project, is discovering an approach to the problem that thinks about it differently, that is constructive and is really focused on getting in front of it and not reacting to it. The media is forced to react to it, right? And it's something that we need to cover. It's in the public interest. These are major traumatic events, but it's tough to do it over and over again.
Over and over again, yeah. So let's dig into some of the findings in Trigger Points. One is that the mass shooting phenomenon is widely misunderstood. And this seemed to me to be not entirely, but in large part, a media problem. That, you know, there are these myths about mass shooters that get repeated basically every time there's a breaking news story about a mass shooting.
That's right. And I think it is a significant problem, as I write about in the book, the recycling of these ideas about mass shooters that are just wrong fundamentally. And at the heart of the matter here is, if we want to do better at solving this problem, we have to understand it better, and the public has to understand it better. And so by sensationalizing mass shootings and who the people are that do these crimes, it's not helpful. So some of those big myths are, one is the idea that this is all about mental illness. We always hear that after a major attack. Mental illness pulled the trigger. The person's totally crazy. And it dovetails with another myth, which is the idea that people who do this are just snapping, right? We hear that question after every single major attack. What made the guy snap? As if it was an impulsive act. Just went off the handle, went out and committed a mass shooting. That's not the case in all of these cases. These are planned attacks. These are people who are thinking about violence over time, days, weeks, months, nurturing grievances, developing plans, and then preparing and deciding to go out and do it. And by understanding that better and understanding the warning signs along the way better, we have opportunity to get in the way of it. So when we hear these things repeated over and over in the media, it's not helpful to recognizing what happens leading up to these and perhaps being able to intervene.
And your book lifts up the experts who actually know how this works, you know, not the armchair quarterback types. If there are heroes and trigger points, they are the forensic psychologists and the FBI agents who are actually able to see warning signs ahead of time.
That's right. And it was really a fascinating project for me in that regard to get to know the people who pioneered this field and who do this work. They're largely out of the public eye, but they're very dedicated to preventing violence. And this is an effective method for it in many cases that I was able to get inside of with the work of the book to see how they're focused on intervention and in many cases, early intervention, which is the ideal of the mm-hmm. work, is to bring together mental health and law enforcement expertise and also other community leaders. I mean, this is a community-based violence prevention model in school systems, in workplaces, in religious institutions, to have a collaborative effort to focus on a person of concern who is raising fear or anxiety in a community that they may be planning violence, and stepping in and saying, hey, what's going on with this person? Gathering information about it, using their collective professional judgment to evaluate the situation and then make a plan for managing it and trying to intervene as constructively as possible. There are many cases that I write about in the book where this is very successful. And we never hear about it. It's not news when nothing happens, right? There's no violent outcome. That's success in these cases. So it's not going to make your show or make the pages of Mother Jones or anywhere else, right? But it's really remarkable work when it's done effectively.
Why did these agents and profilers let you in? And how did you win their trust to talk to them for the book?
It's a great question. It took a while. I think because of the work that I was doing to build the database starting 10 years ago and focusing with some great depth on this problem, trying to understand it better, I think that won some trust with folks. You know, these are sensitive cases. And I mean, law enforcement is very tight-lipped typically. And you're talking about mental health issues and privacy concerns. So it was very hard to work my way into it for a while. But I think when it became clear that my interest was in really understanding this problem better and focusing on a solution, which is what they do, that I was able to gain access. And I also think another interesting development in this regard was that over time in recent years, I think that the leaders in this field have come to understand that greater public awareness of this approach and what they do is very valuable. It's important because most threat assessment cases begin with an ordinary person raising their hand and saying, hey, something's wrong here. I'm worried. Reaching out for help. That kind of tip to people in a position of authority who may work on a threat assessment team or in a program or know who to turn to is often a vital first link in the process.
Right. So these people know they can't be in the shadows. I wonder how much that their jobs have changed, evolved since Columbine. Is Columbine the turning point in trigger points? Is it the turning point for this field? Or do you date it to Sandy Hook, something more recent?
Well, those are both important kind of watershed tragedies in the growth of the field, Columbine especially. I think it's paired with the way that the digital media age was really taking off. Columbine is the internet era, but it predates social media. And what social media has done to sort of evolve and impact this issue is enormous. And I write about that at some length in the book. But Columbine, of course, is what really focused the work of this field on school shootings. Prior to that, the field had been really focused on workplace violence. And the history of it's really quite interesting. I mean, it was originally developed in the 1980s through efforts to prevent assassination, to understand assassination better through a collaboration between forensic psychologists and the Secret Service, seeking to figure out behavioral warning signs in that more narrow context. And then that developed more broadly into focusing on workplace violence with the era of going postal, right? The time when we had all the post office shootings in the 80s and 90s. When Columbine happened, you know, that was a tectonic moment for the field. What are we going to do about this school problem? And Columbine wasn't the first. I think that's a really important thing to note here, because now we tend to think of that as the dawn of the school shootings era. But in fact, there were a rash of school shootings in the late 1990s that were awful and had the country on edge about the notion of a school shootings epidemic. Mm-hmm. So by the time Columbine happens, there's just this major effort now to apply this growing model to school shootings.
Right. And Columbine, of course, was in April. We are now in the month of April. There's references sometimes to April being the beginning of the killing season. Why? Why is that?
Yeah, I heard this anecdotally from a number of people in the field of threat assessment, school shooting season being the late spring. It's kind of remarkable, right? I mean, in one sense, it's sort of a tragic measure of where we are with this problem. But on the other hand, it's also, I think, reflects the hopefulness of the work, because it reflects a better understanding in the field of where the danger is and when and how it happens. And the reason that April is significant and May as well, you know, in part, I heard from people who are involved with this work at the school level, a little bit about the kind of the energy of spring, the way that spring is sort of unleashes energy among youth, and there's sort of a restiveness that comes with that. But more importantly, with respect to this problem, it's when you have historically the major events. Columbine is in April, Virginia Tech is in April, and this relates to the so-called copycat problem, where you have this trend of perpetrators who are looking to predecessors for inspiration and in some cases tactics, and they identify it with them. They want the media attention they got. They want to be like them. And so the threat of attacks escalates at this time of year with school shootings, because there's more of that in the mix.
That does bring up the no notoriety movement again. As you mentioned, that's something that, you know, has received a lot of traction in recent years.
Yes.
Not highlighting, not emphasizing the assailants. Do the experts that you interview say that the press is in the right place there? Needs to go further? Needs to go much further? How would you assess that?
It's a really interesting question. It sort of depends who you talk to. I think that there's general agreement that there's been some significant progress. And I know this is something you focused on before on air, and CNN has taken on in years past. I remember Anderson Cooper as well bringing this up. And it's a balancing act in my view, because as I was saying earlier, you really, you know, reporting on these events is very much in the public interest. We can't not cover it. I mean, as you were saying, like, you felt like you didn't cover Sacramento enough or maybe raise that question. And at the same time, we know from lots of case evidence that by having too much media focus or sensationalized focus on perpetrators, there are bad effects from that. It sort of perpetuates the idea that this is in some sense a valid behavior, that this is something that happens over and over. And we sort of repeat the idea too in our politics of the gun debate, that this problem can't be solved and nothing ever happens. Well, if you're an individual who's maybe contemplating doing this and wants attention for it, that might validate your idea of it, right? So I do think that the news media has started to recognize this better in recent years and change its behavior in some ways. The term that I sort of landed on for this in terms of the balance, what I think is the right balance, is what I call strategic diminishment. So it's not a blackout.
It's not no notoriety.
Yeah. That's right. It's not no notoriety. Well, maybe it is in the sense that we're trying to be careful of lending notoriety, but it's not no coverage, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So we have to find a way to frame the reporting forensically with just enough information to inform the public to understand the problem, but without excessive attention or spotlight on the perpetrators. And one of the ways that I think we do that better now is to pay more attention to the victims and the survivors and the impact of these events, which maybe goes back also to the problem of counting mass shootings, right? If it's just a statistic, 572 a year, that's one thing. But if you show the people's lives, that this is impacting, we start to see more and more, hey, this is a big societal problem. This is, right. I think, a public health issue.
There has been an argument over the years. I'm not sure how much I buy into it, but there has been an argument over the years that a focus on mass shootings, mass killings, takes away from the ugly daily reality of gun violence, that most shootings in America are suicides or are the deaths of a single person at a time. And mass shootings, while spectacular and horrific, are not the norm. So what do you say to that and your focus on mass killings?
Well, I look at that in a couple of ways. One is to say that these are different problems in some ways. I mean, central to them is the method of destruction, but the circumstances and the factors that play into it are different. And so the problem of sort of daily gun violence that we have that happens in different settings or suicide, I think that's just as important, but there are different things we need to understand about what's going on there. Suicide in particular is an important factor in the issue of high impact mass shootings. That's one place where these issues intersect. Because as you note, the majority of gun deaths annually in this country are suicide. But many mass shooters are suicidal. So it becomes an important warning factor in studying the behavioral patterns that lead up to these attacks and allow the opportunity to intervene.
Right. That's very interesting. I have more questions for you, Mark. Let's take a quick break. More on the Reliable Sources podcast in just a moment.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support. Your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're back here on the Reliable Sources podcast. I'm Brian Stelter, speaking with Mark Fullman, whose brand new book is titled Trigger Points, Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Mark, before the break, we talked about a couple examples of news media progress, of improved, wiser coverage of these tragedies. Where are the weaknesses? Where are the areas where the press is still way behind or working off of old myths and misnomers? What would you change if you could just wave a magic wand?
Yeah, I think where there's been real progress is in moving away from the sensationalism that was damaging, that we now know is damaging through case research. So not putting shooters' names in the headlines, not showing their pictures blown up on the front page or on the screen over and over again, posing with guns because they posted that on Facebook before they went on an attack. A lot of that has gone away, and that's a really good development. I think where the problem is now is more about the way that we continue to recycle the myths about the problem, that mass shooters are all insane monsters that we can't relate to in any way and that they just snapped and went off the handle impulsively, or that we could profile these people, predict who's going to do this. Through a set of characteristics or traits or race or ethnicity or gender. None of that is true. None of that works. So I think the media could do a much better job of moving away from that kind of framing too. No longer asking what made the guy snap. Mass shooters don't snap, as we were talking about earlier. These are planned attacks. And not blaming mental illness categorically. There's now significant research both within the field of threat assessment and beyond showing that mental illness is not predictive of violence. Most people who have mental illness are more likely to be victims of violence. But specifically with mass shootings, even more important is that the case studies show that most people who commit this crime are not clinically diagnosable with mental illness. Now, they have mental health problems, of course. I mean, no one commits a mass shooting who is mentally healthy. There's lots of problems going on in these people's lives, but they're not insane. They're not hearing voices telling them to go kill irrationally, completely disconnected from reality. There are very few cases where that's what's going on. I think the media can do a much better job of framing that and also getting away from the sort of cliches that we have that perpetuate the copycat problem. Like every time there's a school shooting, you'll hear people in the media and public officials as well referring to Columbine style attacks. We don't need to say that anymore to understand what this is. And furthermore, by saying it, we're continuing to perpetuate the mythology around Columbine as this world-changing event, which is what the perpetrators wanted.
This is something lazy or easy about the some of the framings that you're debunking. Yeah, like what I mean is to say, oh, yeah, they snapped, or it was mental illness. They were hearing voices. They're crazy. All of those are almost too easy, simplistic explanations for what That's is right. something more complicated, and it always is more complicated. One of the easy explanations, one of the excuses we hear in the wake of these events is violent video games, violent movies. That the media brainwashes kids in that way. Where does the research take us about that?
Yeah, this is something that was really interesting that I learned in the course of writing the book. Looking at that question again, that violent video games and movies and music have been scapegoated for these attacks for decades. It was a big deal after Columbine, and it's stuck around ever since. What the case research shows us is that that's really not true in any causal sense, that kind of material doesn't cause people to commit an attack. However, there is quite a bit of evidence in cases that perpetrators of mass shootings are engaged with that kind of material. And then the question becomes, well, how is that relevant? And there is a correlation that shows that you can see that ways that it connects to other behavioral warning signs. In other words, a person who's not doing well in a kind of a global sense, who is angry, aggrieved, developing a violent idea about maybe committing an attack, is feeling suicidal, and is on this, what they call the pathway to violence, the pathway to attack. People like that in numerous cases are consuming violent media. They're very focused on guns. They're into graphic entertainment. And in some cases, it becomes sort of a tool of psychological rehearsal, or that's what the leaders in this field think and say in some of these cases empirically, that they see perpetrators using violent video games to sort of prepare themselves. But that's not the reason they're going out to do it. So it can be useful as a one of many factors or indicators to gauge a level of danger in a threat case using the method of threat assessment. But it's not causal. That's a myth.
But it's not causal. How did you know when this book was done? I started by pointing out this database that you created began 10 years ago. So this has been a long-term project for you. How did you reach a point to finish?
It's funny you should ask that, because I thought a lot as I was kind of wrapping up the manuscript about how quickly, in a certain sense, it could become outdated because of how frequently these events occur. And so what I realized was that I needed a way to kind of think about, how this would work going forward. And I tried to really grapple with latent trigger points, questions of like, what are the sort of bigger cultural and media forces at work with this problem? Political as well. I mean, political extremism is a rising factor in threat cases in recent years. I don't think that needs much explaining for your listeners. So trying to think more kind of globally about this problem going forward and how this kind of collaborative community-based approach could become a potentially very powerful tool if we can scale it. And that's a much longer term perspective that I think led me to the end of the book, the question of how do we have more of this as an additive tool to solving a very complex problem.
For any author, you land interviews, you gain documents. There might be something that's the most surprising or the, you know, something you're able to get or obtain or interview that's the most important. Do you have something like that? Was there a version of that for you? Because you referenced confidential case files, as well as, you know, the time being spent with these threat assessment teams. Was there a most important sort of document or interview or access point that was critical for you?
It's an interesting question to think about. I think this was very much a cumulative and kind of collective story that I found my way into. And so there were a number of things along the way, but certainly very interesting and surprising at turns. I mean, looking at a lot of the confidential case files and listening to threat assessment experts discuss them was really interesting. And I chronicle some of that activity in the book, particularly in a school setting, just to see how they sort of grapple with the variety of factors going on in a case that in some cases comes down to judgment calls based on experience and kind of collective judgment. It was also really interesting to me to learn about the history of this field and unexpected in some ways. One of the things that the pioneers of this work did was to go and interview a lot of incarcerated perpetrators, mass shooters, and before that, assassins, people and well-known ones, who I won't name for the same sort of principle, but the person who murdered John Lennon in 1980, the person who murdered a young actor by the name of Rebecca Schaefer in Hollywood in 1989. The initial research effort of this field was focused on people like that, going and talking to them and trying to understand their mindset better, as well as all of the circumstances and behaviors that led up to their attack. And I was able to learn a lot about those interviews and get some material related to them that was really quite fascinating, that you can really see the foundation of this method emerging through that study.
And I have to ask about how you perceive guns and think about guns, given that you've been living for years inside this story about one part of the gun violence epidemic in the U.S. I mean, for people who listened to last week's podcast, I was talking to Stuart Ramsey, the Sky News correspondent who was wounded in Ukraine, and he described getting back to the UK and needing to have a bullet wound cleaned up, and how, you know, in the UK, there's not that many surgeons who have that much expertise in it because there's just not that many incidents of gun violence. He made a quip about it, in knowing that, you know, he was reaching partly an American audience, and we have all too much experience with these sorts of things. Yeah. Did it make you look around as an American, as a reporter, and think, what's wrong with this country?
I think I've certainly felt that way in years past. And in some ways, that's why I set out to write this book, because, you know, this approach to thinking about it and trying to further solve the issue is really about trying to make better sense of it and seeing it as a problem that is sort of bigger and more complicated than the entrenched political debates we have over and over. So, you know, my views about guns, I wouldn't say changed broadly in any way. I think I just have become more persuaded that we need to think more expansively about this problem in order to make progress on it and to kind of meet the reality of it where it is. I mean, we have a majority population that believes that we need to have more effective gun laws. That's an essential terrain for solving this problem, obviously. And yet, years go by, decades go by, and we're stuck in a lot of the same battles. And we have a very patchwork system for regulating guns throughout the country. And unless and until that changes, this is the reality we live in. There are nearly 400 million guns in this country. And if you're on the side of the political spectrum that doesn't like that and wants to get rid of them, you can keep saying that, but that's not going to change anytime soon. So for me, it really became more a matter of what more can we do here about this? Surely we can solve this problem better than we are now. We do all kinds of amazing things in the United States, in our culture, inventing things and solving things. So why is this problem still regarded as so unsolvable, so intractable. That's probably where, how my thinking about it has evolved the most. I think my thinking about guns was pretty clear years ago from looking into the problem. And I say so at the outset of the book, you know, we can do much better with gun regulations, no doubt. And most of the country wants that. There's an incredible disconnect between what the population says consistently it wants, including conservatives and gun owners, about firearms, and a disconnect between that and what happens politically in the country.
Right. But your book does present many examples of real possibility for change, real reasons for optimism. The stories that you usually never hear on the news about mass shootings that are prevented. So for that reason, folks should check it out. The title is Trigger Points: Inside the Mission to Stop Mass Shootings in America. Mark, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Brian. It was a pleasure.
Thanks. And thank you all for tuning in for this week's episode. We will see you on TV this Sunday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time on CNN and every weekday now on CNN Plus for Reliable Sources Daily. Thanks so much for tuning in.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.